Disc 6.
Quest ignored the FBI representative. "We're going to come at the Saudi obliquely," she told Lincoln. "We know of an al-Qaeda cell in the Balkans that's been running guns and ammunition into the Muslims in Sarajevo in the belief that war between the Serbs and Bosnians is inevitable. Guy who directs it is an Azerbaijani who uses the name Sami Akbar. Our plan is to hang you out to dry on the Dalmatian coast, which is Sami's stamping ground, and let him stumble across you. Once you've established your bona fides and whet his appetite, you reach the Saudi by working your way up the chain of command. In Triple Border, he's said to use Daoud as a doorkeeper. Nobody gets to the Saudi without getting past the Egyptian." Crystal Quest, dressed in one of her signature pantsuits with wide lapels and a dress shirt with frills down the chest, scraped back her chair and stood up. Taking their cue from her, the Wallahs from the DDO jumped to their feet. "Get it into your head that Triple Border isn't the Club Med," Quest reminded Lincoln. "The group we know least about, the group which interests us the most, is this al-Qaeda entity. Bring home the bacon on the Saudi and al-Qaeda, Lincoln, and I'll personally see to it you get one of the company's jockstrap medals." She added with a leer, "Pin it on you myself." The DDO contingent all laughed. As Quest headed for the door, Kick offered his hand across the table, and Lincoln, half rising from his chair, shook it. "Our cutout will make herself known to you by saying something about Giovanni de Verrazzano and the bridge named after him." Kick added, "Holy mackerel, watch your ass when you get to Triple Border. You'll be rubbing shoulders with mighty ornery folks." Crystal Quest's voice, suffused with satisfaction at her own morbid sense of humor, came drifting back over her shoulder. "Whatever you do, Lincoln, stay away from swimming pools." Hanging out with Leroy Streeter in a booth at the rear of the Kit Kat Club on the main drag of Foz do Iguaçu for the second night running, polishing off the last of the sirloin steak and French fries, washing it down with cheap scotch in a shot glass and lukewarm beer chasers drunk straight from the bottle, Lincoln watched the hookers slotting coins into the jukebox and swaying in each other's arms to the strains of "Don't Worry, Be Happy," which, judging from the fact that it was played over and over, night after night, was either number one on the Brazilian hit parade or the only 45 RPM record in the machine still functioning. Leroy had just come down the narrow stairs leading to a dark hallway with two bedrooms off of it, having gotten his ashes hauled, as he put it, for the second time that night. The skinny teenage girl with the red-dyed hair worked into a chignon on the top of her head to add height and age came down behind him, ironing the folds of a thin shift with her palms as she tottered back to the bar on spiked high heels. "I prefer jail bait," Leroy informed his newfound friend as he signaled for another bottle of beer. "They got theirselves tight snatches and do whichever you tell them to do without raising a fuss or renegotiating the price. Can't figure out what you got against getting laid, Lincoln. Like I told you, the girls here is all clean as whistles." "They're only clean as the last whistle they blew," Lincoln said. "Last thing I need to come down with is gonorrhea, wind up costing me $250,000 to get screwed." "I see what you're saying," Leroy said. He looked over at the dancers padding around on the broad pine planks of the floor in front of the jukebox. One young man, whom Leroy had identified as a Pakistani he'd seen at Daoud's boondock training camp, was hugging Leroy's skinny friend with the red-dyed hair and dancing in place, shifting his weight from foot to foot in time to the music. "I don't hold with females dancing with females," the Texan told Lincoln, aiming his chin in the direction of the hookers who hung limply in each other's arms, their backs slightly arched, their painted lids closed, their heads falling off to one side as if their necks weren't strong enough to support the weight of their elaborate hairdos. "It ain't normal, is my view, in the sense that lesbian love ain't normal. If God meant women to fuck women, he would have given some of them dicks. The hell kind of music is that, anyway? Don't worry, be happy is how I aim to pass the rest of my days on Earth once all this is over with." Lincoln decided the moment had come to see whether his efforts at bonding with the Texan had paid off. Bending over the table, lowering his voice so the two Brazilians in the next booth couldn't make out what he was saying, he asked, "Once all what is over with?" "It's got to do with the ammonium nitrate, right? Tell me something, Leroy. What the fuck would anyone do with a moving van stuffed with ammonium nitrate?" He managed to ask the question very casually, as if he were only trying to hold up his end of the conversation, as if he couldn't care less about the answer. Leroy, a little man who wanted people to think of him as big, couldn't resist bragging. "Between you and me and the fly on the wall over there, I'm going to go and personally drive it through the Holland Tunnel," he replied, leaning forward until their foreheads were almost touching. "Going to set the fuse and blow it up in downtown Manhattan and flatten a square mile of Wall Street real estate is what I'm going to do with it." Sinking back, Lincoln whistled through his teeth. "You guys aren't fucking around. You're going straight for the jugular." "Fucking ain't we're not fucking around," Leroy said, squirming gleefully on his banquette. Lincoln raised the bottle to his lips and swallowed a mouthful of warm beer. "What you got against Wall Street, Leroy? Did you lose money on the stock market?" Leroy sniffed at the air in the Kit Kat Club, which reeked of beer and marijuana and perspiration. "I hate the federal government," he confided. "And that there Wall Street is a branch of the federal government. Wall Street is where them Jews hang out, running the country from behind their polished mahogany desks, plotting to take over the whole entire world. Whether you admit it or not, you know I'm right, or you wouldn't be doing what you're doing. You're a foot soldier like me in the War of Liberation. Hell, we may have to destroy America to liberate her, but one way or another we are going to go and set the clock back to where right-thinking folks can get on with their lives without being dictated to by some pompous asshole in Washington. It's a civil war all over again, Lincoln. The federal government's trying to tell us what we can do and what we can't do. Things keep up the way they've been going, hell, they're going to throw away the Constitution and decide you need to get yourself a license before you can own a handgun." Leroy kept his voice pitched low, but he was starting to rant now. "A license to buy a handgun over my dead body? Listen up, Lincoln, you got yourself book learning, so you know the country is going to the dogs. Give the cocks and niggers an inch, they'll come right back at you for a country mile. If we don't draw the limit line in the dirt, if we don't make our stand now, why, one day soon they're going to bus the niggers to every goddamn school in the country until there won't be such a thing as a white man's school left between the Pacific and the Atlantic." Leroy seemed to run out of steam just as the mulatto girl working the bar turned up with his beer. She deftly flicked off the cap with a church key hanging between her breasts at the end of a long gold necklace. "Ready for a refill?" she asked Lincoln. The bottle of beer on the table in front of him was still half full. "I'm okay," he said. "He is definitely okay," Leroy agreed impatiently. The waitress told Leroy, "My girlfriend, Paura, she's the dark-haired one in toreador pants dancing all by herself over there, has taken a shine to your friend here." "You don't say," Leroy said. He smirked across the table at Lincoln. "Why don't you invite Paura over for a beer, Lincoln? If you don't fancy her, I'll take her on." "I told you," Lincoln started to say, but Leroy had already grabbed the waitress's wrist. "Go and tell this Paura chick to get her ass over here." The waitress could be seen laughing and saying something to her friend as she headed back to the bar. Paura, holding an enormous joint between two fingers of her left hand, slowly turned her head and sized up the two men in the booth, then went on with her dancing, though each shuffling step brought her closer to the rear of the bar. She kept dancing even after the record stopped and wound up swaying like a leaf in a faint breeze next to the booth as "Don't Worry, Be Happy" started in again. She took a drag on her joint and swallowed the smoke and said, "I bet she told you my name's Paura." "She did," Leroy affirmed. "She never gets it right." The girl spoke English with what Lincoln took to be an Italian accent. "I'm Paura some days. On others, I'm Lucia. Today is a lucha day." Lincoln, an aficionado of legends as well as firearms, asked, "Are those different names for the same person or two distinct people?" Lucha scrutinized Lincoln to see if he was mocking her. When she saw he was serious, she answered his question seriously. "They're as distinct as night and day. Lucia is day. Her name in Italian means light. Sunshine and daylight fill her heart. She is grateful to be alive and lives from day to day. She doesn't see past tomorrow. She goes down on anyone who pays without haggling. She considers it a matter of principle to give a client his money's worth. She passes on half of what she earns to her pimp and does not hold back his share if a client should happen to leave a tip." And Paura, what's she like?
Paura is night. Her name means fear in Italian. Everything about her can be traced to fear. She is afraid of her shadow during the day, afraid of the darkness when the last light has been drained from the day, afraid of the customers who remove their belts before they take off their trousers. She's afraid of a swimming pools. She is afraid life on earth will end before dawn tomorrow, afraid it will go on forever.
She regarded Lincoln with her frightened eyes.
Would you like me to read your palm? I can tell you on what day of the week your life will come to an end.
Lincoln politely declined. I have no visible lifeline, he said. The girl tried another tack.
What a sign were you born under?
Lincoln shook his head. I'm a zodiac atheist. Don't know my sign, don't want to know.
That more or less narrows our relationship down to dancing,
Lucia said, her body starting to sway to the music again. Shrugging the filmy blouse so far off one shoulder that the aureole on a breast came into view, she held out a hand.
She's a nutcase, Leroy muttered, but she sure has got the hots for you.
I have a bad leg, Lincoln informed the girl.
Go ahead and put her out of her misery,
Leroy urged.
Jesus Christ, he can't catch nothing just dancing with her.
When Lincoln still held back, Leroy nudged his ankle under the table.
You ain't being a gentleman, Lincoln, that's for goddamn sure.
Lincoln pulled a face and shrugged and slid off the banquette to his feet. The Italian girl gripped one of his large hands in hers and pulled him limping into the middle of the room, then turned and, stomping out her joint on the floorboards, melted against him, both of her bare arms flung around his neck, her teeth nibbling on the lobe of his ear. In the booth, Leroy slapped the table in delight. Lincoln was a good dancer, favoring his game leg, and with the girl glued to his lanky frame, he launched into an awkward little three-step that set the other girls around the bar to watching in admiration. After a bit, Lucia whispered in Lincoln's ear,
"You don't need to tell me your names if you don't want to. Wouldn't change anything if you did. Around here, nobody uses real names."
"Name's Lincoln."
"That a first name or family name?"
"First."
"That your name during daylight or at night?"
Lincoln had to smile.
"Both."
Without missing a beat, Lucia said,
"Giovanni da Varazzano, who gave his daylight name to the bridge that connects Brooklyn to an island named Staten, was killed by Indians during an expedition to Brazil in 1528. A little bird whispering in my ear told me you would be thrilled to know that."
Lincoln stopped in his tracks and pushed her off to arm's length. The smile sat like a mask on his face. "As a matter of fact, I am." Lucia, quite pleased with herself, tucked her breast into her blouse with a dip and toss of her shoulder and sank back into his arms, and they started dancing again. Lincoln, suddenly edgy, pressed his mouth to her ear.
"So it's you, the cutout," he said.
He thought of Jamila in the room over the bar in Beirut, with the faded night moth tattooed under her right breast. He remembered telling her,
"I am addicted to fear. I require a daily fix."
You had to be addicted to fear to get into the business of spying. This is the thing he had in common with the Italian girl Paura. She had surely been the cutout who had seen the FBI asset thrown to the crocodile. Lincoln identified the source of his edginess. He hoped against hope she wouldn't suffer the same fate. "Do you have a good memory?" he asked her now. Without waiting for a reply, he said, "Here goes nothing. I was picked up by the Texan sitting at the table with me. I believe his name really is Leroy Streeter, because he mentioned that his father had burned down a Negro church in Alabama. He took me to a room over a bar in Ciudad del Este. The Egyptian named Daoud was there."
"It's no skin off of my nose if you don't want sex," Lucia said. "I've had enough sex for one day. My pussy and my mouth are both sore."
Daoud checked out my bona fides. I heard him go upstairs and make a phone call. My guess is he was getting his people to confirm that I'd been treated in a Trieste clinic, that I'd written the book I said I wrote. I must have passed the initial muster because he sent me back here and told me to hang out with Leroy until I was contacted again, which is what I'm doing now.
"The reason we play the same record all the time," Lucia whispered, her tongue flicking inside his ear, "is because Don't Worry, Be Happy is the opposite of our lives down here. Except for Lucia, all we do is worry about not being happy."
With any luck, the next step is for me to be taken to meet the Saudi.
The girls who work here, Lucha said, use abortions as birth control. If you ever come back again, it will be appreciated if you would bring us a carton of condoms.
Leroy told me why they're shopping around for ammonium nitrate, Lincoln went on. I don't know if he's bragging or inventing, but he says he plans to fill a moving van with explosives and blow it up in the middle of Wall Street. He let one of his palms slip down to her tight toreador pants and the swell of a buttock. What will you do when all this is over?
Lucha dropped one of her hands to reach under the back of Lincoln's shirt. All this will never be over, she breathed.
Her answer startled Lincoln. That was what the Alawite prostitute Jamila had told Dante Pippin as he was leaving the room over the bar in Beirut a legend ago. It will end one day, Lincoln promised her. Where will you go? What will you do?
I will go back to Tuscany, she said,
clinging to him, burrowing into his neck so that her words were muffled.
I would buy a small farm and breed baby polyesters, and shear them twice a year and sell the hair to make silk soft cloth.
Polyester is a synthetic fabric, Lincoln said. Lucha's hand came in contact with the leather of the holster nestling in the cavity in Lincoln's lower back. She caressed the cold metal on the butt of the small-caliber automatic in the holster.
I will raise baby acrylics, then, she said, annoyed at his nitpicking.
Her fingers worked their way under the holster. When they reached the smooth scar of the healed wound, she stopped dancing abruptly.
What gave you that? She asked.
But Lincoln only murmured her night name, Paura, and she didn't repeat the question. Hanging out at the Kit Kat Club the following night, Lincoln made a point of dancing with two other girls and taking the second one up to a room so that suspicion wouldn't fall on Paura if he was compromised. Once in the room, the girl, a bleached blonde who called herself Monroe Marilyn, named her price. Lincoln counted out the bills and set them on the table. Monroe washed in a chipped bidet and insisted he wash too, and watched him to make sure he did. She took off the rest of her clothing, except for a black lace brassiere, which she claimed to have bought in Paris, and stretched out on the mattress covered with a stained sheet, her legs apart, her eyes fixed on the filaments in the electric bulb dangling from the ceiling. In the bar below, Don't Worry, Be Happy started to play again on the jukebox. Lincoln shut his eyes and imagined he was making love to Paura. Under him, Marilyn moaned and cried out with pleasure. To Lincoln, her sensual clatter came across as a recorded announcement, played over and over like the 45 RPM disc on the jukebox downstairs. He finished before Don't Worry, Be Happy did.
So you got your ashes hauled after all, Leroy said when Lincoln came limping back to the booth and slid onto the banquette across from him. You must have broken some kind of speed record. You need to get laid at least once a day not to be sex-starved. The trick is to make it last as long as you can. That way you get more fuck for your buck.
You ought to write a Lonely Hearts column for the newspapers, Lincoln said. You could advise men how to solve their sexual problems.
I may just do that when I'm too old to take on the federal government in Washington.
How old will you be when you're too old for the good fight?
30, maybe. Maybe 30.
Around 11, an old man wearing a long, shabby overcoat and a threadbare scarf wound loosely around his thin neck came into the bar to sell lottery tickets. He had turned up the same hour every night since Lincoln had been hanging out at the Kit Kat. As he stepped through the door, the hookers dropped what they were doing to crowd around him, hunting for lucky numbers on the lottery slips attached to his clipboard. When they'd each bought a ticket that suited them, the girls drifted back to the tables or took up where they'd left off on the dance floor. The lottery vendor shuffled across the floor to a vacant booth not far from where Lincoln and Leroy were sitting. The mulatto waitress filled a tall glass with tap water and set it down in front of him. The old man half bowed to her from a sitting position. The gesture seemed to come from another world and another century. A new girl Lincoln had not seen before came down the steps behind a corpulent Lebanese client and, noticing the old man with the clipboard in the booth, hurried over to buy a ticket. When the music went silent, Lincoln could hear their voices. He could even make out what they were saying. The girl was asking when the drawing would be held and how she would know if she'd won anything. The old man told her that he kept the stubs attached to his clipboard for months. Each morning he tore the list of winning numbers from the newspaper, he said, and made it his business to personally seek out winners who had bought a ticket from him. The idea of a hooker hoping to strike it rich from a lottery ticket intrigued Lincoln. He wondered if her pimp would take half the proceeds if she did win. Leroy was listening to them also. He reached across the table and tapped Lincoln on the wrist.
"The hell language they talking?" he wanted to know.
Lincoln hadn't realized they were talking a foreign language until Leroy called his attention to it.
"Not sure," he replied, although to his astonishment he found that he knew very well.
The old lottery vendor and the hooker were talking in Polish, which was the language Martin Odom's mother had used when she told him bedtime stories in Jonestown, Pennsylvania, a lifetime ago. At the booth, the girl could be heard asking, "Ile kostuje bilet?" When the old man told her how much a ticket cost, she carefully counted out coins from a small purse and tore one from the clipboard.
"Sounds foreign to me," Leroy was saying. "Don't like foreigners, don't like the languages they talk. Don't know why foreigners don't learn American. Make the world simpler if everyone talked American, is how I see it."
Lincoln couldn't resist baiting Leroy. "You want them to talk American with a Texas drawl like you? Or a clipped Boston accent like John Kennedy?" Leroy took the question seriously. "Don't matter none to me. Any American beats out a foreign language, hands down." Near midnight, as the girls began to drift over to the bar to settle up what they owed for the rooms they'd used, the fat Arab boy who'd been doing the jigsaw puzzle in Ciudad del Este burst into the bar. He was still wearing the shoulder holster with the plastic grip of a handgun jutting from it. Spotting the two Americans in the rear booth, he padded over on his Reeboks and thrust out a folded note. Leroy read it and raised his eyes and cried out excitedly, "Bingo, Lincoln! Daoud is waiting for us behind the bar!" Daoud's coal-black Mercedes was idling in the shadows at the street end of the alley when the two Yankees, the one with the cane limping along behind the short American in cowboy boots, came around the side of the Kit Kat and settled into the back seat. The fat Arab boy slid in next to Daoud in front. "Where are you taking us?" Lincoln asked, but Daoud didn't bother to reply. He gestured to the driver, and the car lurched past the halal butcher shop on the corner, into the poorly lit main drag, and headed in the direction of the Little Dipper and Polaris, hanging in the night sky over the rooftops. 20 minutes out of Foz do Iguaçu, the paved road abruptly gave way to a rutted dirt track, and the driver had to slow down to keep the passengers from hitting their heads against the roof of the car. In the headlights, Indians leading donkeys piled high with burlap sacks could be seen stumbling through the pitch darkness.
"In the outback," Leroy told Lincoln, "a lot of smuggling goes on during the night."
After one particularly rough bump, Daoud flung an arm over the shoulder of the fat teenager and said something to him in Arabic. The boy said, "Inshallah." Lincoln leaned forward to ask the Egyptian if the boy were his son. Daoud turned his head only slightly and said,
"He is the son of my son."
"And where is his father?"
"His father, my son, was killed in the attack on the American Marines at Beirut Airport in 1983.
Lincoln reminded himself he was living deep in a legend, that he ought to be commiserating with the Egyptian.
"It must be a source of great sadness to have lost your son." "It is a source of great pride to have given a son to the jihad. Along with my son, 241 American Marines and sailors lost their lives in the Beirut attack, after which your President Reagan lost his nerve and disengaged from Lebanon. Every father should have such a son."
An hour and 20 minutes out of Foz do Iguaçu, the headlights of the Mercedes picked up the first of two roadblocks. Soon after the second one, located beyond a sharp curve in the track, the car slowed to give three armed men with red and white checkered keffiyehs over their faces time to drag open a chain-link gate. One of the guards said something into a walkie-talkie as he waved the Mercedes through. The driver headed downhill toward a group of wooden army barracks set in what looked like a dry riverbed, and pulled up before a structure that was lower and wider than the other buildings. On a flat rise behind the barracks, in a dirt field illuminated by floodlights powered by a gasoline-driven motor whose putt-putt was audible in the still night air, a dozen men in khaki fatigues were practicing penalty shots against a goalie outfitted in a yellow Hertz jumpsuit. When one of them scored, Lincoln could make out the other players taunting the guardian. Daoud's son darted from the Mercedes to pull open a narrow door in the side of the building. The young Pakistani whom Lincoln had seen dancing at the Kit Kat with Leroy's jailbait hooker stood in the corridor inside the door, an Israeli Uzi with spare clips taped to the folding metal stock tucked under an arm, his finger on the trigger. He tensed when he saw the two Americans and muttered something to Daoud, who translated. "He wants to know if you are armed." Lincoln, laughing, reached under his shirt behind his back and pulled the small caliber automatic from the holster worn high on his belt so that it would disappear into the shrapnel wound. The Pakistani took the automatic and waved the party through. The corridor gave onto a square room with a low ceiling. It took a moment for Lincoln's eyes to become accustomed to the dimness. About 30 or so men sat around the room on straw matting, their backs against thin cushions attached to the walls. Daoud motioned Lincoln and Leroy to a spot along the near wall, then crossed the room and took a free place against the opposite wall, near the figure who was clearly presiding. Lincoln set his cane on the cement floor and settled down, his bad leg stretched out in front of him, the other ankle tucked under his thigh. Next to him, Leroy sank into an awkward cross-legged position. Lincoln reached for his tin of Schimmelpenix, but a lean young Arab posed a hand gently but firmly on his wrist. Lincoln noticed that nobody in the room was smoking. He nodded and grinned at the young Arab, who turned away expressionless. Lincoln tried to distinguish the features of the figure across from him. The man, who looked to be in his mid-30s, was ruggedly handsome, with stringy ash-colored beard and dark, thoughtful eyes exuding an inner calm that could have easily been taken for arrogance. He was extremely tall and dressed in a collarless, coarse, off-white ankle-length robe with what Lincoln took to be a thick Afghan goat-hair vest over it. Bareheaded, with socks and heavy walking sandals on his feet, he sat cross-legged on the mat with a supple elegance, his back off the wall and hunched slightly forward as he read something from a sheet of paper to those within earshot, occasionally tapping the long forefinger of his right hand on a word to emphasize its importance. All Lincoln could make out was the honeyed undertone of someone who didn't need to raise his voice to be heard. There appeared to be some sort of cue, because the two men sitting between Daoud and the figure Lincoln identified as the Saudi spoke next, raising problems that needed to be solved or providing information that needed to be weighed against what was already known. Finally, Daoud's turn came. Leaning forward, talking quietly, he spoke to the Saudi for several minutes. Once he tossed his head to indicate the two Americans sitting across the room. Only then did the Saudi's gaze settle on the visitors. He scratched at his chest with several fingers and uttered a single word. Daoud looked over and motioned for Lincoln to approach. Leroy assumed the gesture included him and started to get up, but Daoud wagged a finger and he collapsed back into his cramped position. Leaning on his cane, Lincoln pushed himself to his feet and walked over to the Saudi and sank onto his haunches facing him. The Saudi saluted him with a palm to his heart, and Lincoln mimicked the gesture. A thin man with greasy hair parted down the middle and thick spectacles slipping along his nose was sitting next to the Saudi with a lined notebook open on his lap. Lincoln took him for a secretary. The Saudi murmured something, and the secretary repeated it in a loud voice. Instantly, all the men sitting around the walls sprang to their feet and headed for the door. Across the room, only Leroy remained, squirming uncomfortably in a position he would never grow accustomed to. Lincoln looked from Daoud to his host and back as Daoud delivered a short speech in Arabic. The Saudi listened intently, nodding from time to time in apparent agreement, his eyes darting occasionally to Lincoln and once to Leroy across the room. Finally, the Saudi, scratching again at his chest, started to put questions. The secretary with the greasy hair translated them into English.
"He welcomes you to Boa Vista. He asks how you arrived to here from Croatia."
"I flew Lufthansa from Zagreb to Munich to Paris, then Air France to New York, then Pan Am to Sao Paulo. I chartered a small plane that flew me into Foz do Iguaçu."
When the secretary had translated this, the Saudi, never lifting his eyes from Lincoln, put another question. The secretary said,
"He asks how the struggle is going in Bosnia. He asks whether the Bosnians, in the event of war, will be able to defend Sarajevo if the Serbs capture the hills overlooking the city."
"The Serb military is, by all accounts, a great deal stronger than anything the Bosnians can field," Lincoln said. "What will strengthen the Bosnians in the event of war is that they have no place to go. Their backs are against Croatia, and the Croats hate them as much as the Serbs."
"He agrees with your analysis. He tells the story of the Greek general who warned his officers not to attack a weaker force trapped in a canyon without a line of retreat available, because the weaker force would then conquer the stronger force."
The Saudi spoke again. Again the secretary translated.
"He asks how you plan to accumulate large quantities of ammonium nitrate without attracting the attention of the police."
Almost against his will, Lincoln felt himself falling under the spell of the Saudi. He saw, now that he was close to him, that the skin on the Saudi's face and neck appeared yellowish, but he assumed it was due to the low wattage of the bulbs burning in the room. He couldn't help but like his style. No wonder young men were flocking to join his Al-Qaeda cells in Afghanistan and Yemen. Watching his unflinching eyes, Lincoln could feel the magnetic pull of his personality. The Saudi spoke softly, but he carried a big stick. Seeing how uncomfortable his visitor was, the Saudi reached out to offer him a cushion. Lincoln sat on it, his game leg thrust forward, and provided an explanation that had been prepared back at Langley. His several associates would spread out across America and, pretending to represent farmers' cooperatives in various southern and eastern states, would buy up whatever ammonium nitrate was available and truck it to New Jersey, where it would all be loaded onto a moving van. At a site to be designated, Leroy Streeter would take possession of the ammonium nitrate and pay the fee in cash.
"He asks if you are curious to know what Mr. Streeter plans to do with the ammonium nitrate."
"I suppose he plans to explode it someplace. Tell you the truth, I couldn't care less."
"He asks why you could not care less."
"I believe America has grown too rich and too fat and too insolent, and needs to be taken down a peg or two." It was clear from the secretary's expression that he didn't understand the expression, "a peg or two." Lincoln repeated the thought another way. "America needs to be taught a lesson in humility."
"He asks what kinds of arms you sold in the Balkans."
"All kinds. My clients would give me a wish list, and I did my best to fill it."
"What is it, the wish list?"
"A list of the arms and munitions that they wished to have."
"He asks if you have limited your operations to conventional weapons."
"My operations have been limited to selling what the Soviet military has in its stocks. Up to now, I have procured almost all of the weapons and munitions from Soviet army units in East Germany. Many of the Russians I dealt with have returned to the Soviet Union and would be able to supply me with other articles from the Soviet arsenal. Do you have something particular in mind?"
"He asks whether you could supply spent plutonium or enriched uranium."
Lincoln thought about that for a moment. "Spent plutonium or enriched uranium waste could be obtained from nuclear power plants like the one in Chernobyl, north of Kiev in the Ukraine." The Saudi interrupted Lincoln, and the secretary translated what he said.
"He is curious why you mentioned Chernobyl, since its reactor exploded 5 years ago and the radioactive waste has been sealed under an enormous concrete sheath."
"It was the plant's No. 4 reactor that exploded. Two other reactors remain in use. The radioactive waste is trucked to various nuclear disposal sites in the Soviet Union. There is another source of spent plutonium. The Soviet nuclear submarine fleet, based in Archangel and Murmansk, is known to be decommissioning vessels because of budgetary shortfalls. Plutonium pits are removed from the decommissioned subs and trucked to the same nuclear disposal sites. The bottom line is that there is no shortage of weapons-grade plutonium or uranium for anyone willing to run the risks involved in negotiating the acquisition. It goes without saying, very large sums of money would be required to conclude such a deal." The Saudi accepted the translation with a preoccupied nod. He muttered something to the secretary, who said,
"He asks how large?"
"How much radioactive waste would be required?"
"He says to you a tenth of a short ton to start with."
"Where would he want it delivered?"
"At a site to be specified in Afghanistan."
"I would need to consult my associates before setting a price. Off the top of my head, I should think we are talking about something in the neighborhood of $1 million U.S. A down payment in cash when I have located the spent pits, the rest to be paid into a numbered account in an offshore bank."
"He asks, is it so that nuclear bombs can be fitted into something the size of a common valise?"
"He's referring to what the Americans have designated the MK-47. The Soviets are said to have constructed several hundred of these devices. Imagine something shaped like an army canteen, only larger, roughly the size of a bulging valise, with an automobile gas cap on the top and two metal handles on either side. Because of its size and mobility, the nuclear device can be easily smuggled into a target city and exploded by a crude timing mechanism. The MK-47s contain 22 pounds of uranium, which, when exploded, is equivalent to 1,000 tons of conventional TNT, 1/20th the size of the first Hiroshima atomic bomb."
"He asks about the shelf life of these valise bombs."
The Russians have been miniaturizing their nuclear payloads since the mid-1980s. Whatever they have in their stockpiles could be expected to function for 10 to 15 years. He wants to know if such a Velise bomb can be acquired. For obvious reasons, the Russian military kept these devices under lock and key, with a high degree of command and control accountability. But if someone were to offer an enormous sum of money, plus safe passage out of Russia for the seller, it is conceivable that something might be worked out. He asks how much money is an enormous sum. Again, off the top of my head, I would say something in the neighborhood of 3 to 5 million U.S. for each Velise bomb. The Saudi sank back into the cushion fastened to the wall behind him and scratched absently at his upper arm and his ribs. Lincoln noticed that the Saudi was sweating despite the chill in the room, that the sweat on his brow seemed to crystallize into a fine white powder. He says to you that for the time being we will concentrate on the spent plutonium or uranium pits. He says that nobody can say what the future holds. Perhaps one day he will raise the subject of the Velise bomb again with you. Lincoln smiled and nodded. It's your call. There was a large glass bowl filled with fruit, and another overflowing with nuts near the Saudi. He pointed first to one and then the other with a hand turned palm up, offering something to eat to his guest. Lincoln reached out to help himself to some nuts. He notes that it turns cold at night out here, the secretary translated. He asks if you and your friend would like some herbal tea. Lincoln looked at Leroy over his shoulder and said, "He is offering us hot herbal tea." "Ask him if they got anything slightly more alcoholic," Leroy said. "Leroy, these people don't drink alcohol. It's against their religion." "God damn, how can they expect folks to convert to a dry religion?" The Saudi apparently caught the gist of Leroy's remark because he replied in Arabic without waiting for the secretary to translate. The secretary said, "He tells the story of the Tsar who converted Russia to Christianity. It was near the end of the first millennium. Vladimir I of Kiev was tempted by Islam, but decided against it because he did not think Russians could get through their cruel winters without something the Arab chemists who developed the technique of distillation called alkul. History might have turned out differently if the prophet had not abstained from alcohol. The long Cold War would have been between Christianity and Islam." Lincoln said, "With the collapse of the Soviet Union, perhaps there will be another Cold War. A new struggle for Jerusalem between the spiritual descendants of Richard the Lionhearted and the heirs of the Sultan Saladin." Listening to the translation, the Saudi reached for a glass filled with water and, popping two large oval pills into his mouth, washed them down with a long swig. Lincoln watched his Adam's apple bob in his long neck. Wiping his lips with the fabric on the back of a wrist, the Saudi said in labored English, "A new struggle is surely a possibility." "You speak English?" Lincoln asked him directly. The Saudi responded in Arabic, and the secretary translated. "He says to you he speaks English as well as you speak Arabic." Lincoln grinned. "I understand 4 words of Arabic, Allah Akbar and Inshallah." "He compliments you. He says to you the person who understands only these 4 words grasps the heart of the Holy Quran. He says to you there are pious men, descendants of the Prophet, who can recite all 114 surahs from memory, but do not hold in their hearts the significance of these 4 words. Lincoln looked at the Saudi. "Are you pious? Do you practice your religion?" "He says to you he practices as much of it as needs to be practiced to be a faithful Muslim. He says to you that he resides in what Muslims call Dar al-Harb, the home of war. Above all other things, he practices jihad. He would have you know that waging war on behalf of Islam and Allah against the infidel is a Quranic obligation." Lincoln nodded at the Saudi, who inclined his head in a sign of esteem for the foreigner who appeared to respect him. "What happened then?" Crystal Quest demanded when Lincoln, back in Washington, described the meeting at the training camp in the Brazilian Mato Grosso. "He threw questions at me for another 20 minutes, and I fielded them. It was all very low-keyed. At one point, he got into a long discussion with the Egyptian, Daoud. For 5 or so minutes, it was almost as if I didn't exist. Then, without saying another word to me, the Saudi climbed to his feet and departed. I heard the motors of 3 or 4 cars kick into life behind the building and saw their headlights sweep into and out of the room as they headed deeper into the Mato Grasso. Daoud signaled that the meeting had come to an end and ushered Leroy and me back to his Mercedes, and we started back toward Foz do Iguaçu. The Egyptian told me I'd made a good impression on the Saudi. He said I was to return to the United States and organize the purchase and delivery of the ammonium nitrate at mid-month to an abandoned hangar off the Pulaski Skyway in New Jersey. Lincoln produced a page that had been torn out of a lined notebook. The address is written here. Quest snatched the scrap of paper. "What about the Saudi and his radioactive waste?" she asked. Daoud invited me to return to Boa Vista on the night of the new moon to meet the Saudi and organize with him the delivery of the 200 pounds of spent plutonium. "Describe the Saudi again, Lincoln." "It's all in my mission report. His name was never mentioned, either by Daoud or by the secretary translating for him at the meeting in Boa Vista. I would estimate he was roughly 6'5" and in his middle 30s. Quest cut in. "Guessing someone's age has never been your strong suit. How old do you think the cutout was?" "The hooker in the Kit Kat? I'd say she was in her late 30s or early 40s. "Proves my point," Quest told the Wallas, who had crowded into her office to attend Lincoln's debriefing. "The girl, the youngest daughter of an old Roman family, is 27. Her real name is Fiamma Segre. She's been doing hard drugs for years. That's why she looks old before her time. Go on with your description of the Saudi." Lincoln, resting his elbows on the cane stretched like a span between the two arms of the chair, closed his eyes and tried to summon an image of the Saudi. "He's charismatic. That's a load of crap, Lincoln. What do we put on the advisory we send out to our stations? Wanted dead or alive, one charismatic Saudi." Lincoln's patience was wearing thin. He was bone-tired. The car ride back to Sao Paulo and the flight back to the States had worn him out. The grilling by Fred and her Wallas was shaping up as the straw that would break the camel's back. "I'm doing the best I can." "Your best needs to be better." "Maybe if he were to get some shut-eye," ventured one of the bolder Wallas. Quest didn't like to be second-guessed. "Maybe if you were to get yourself a posting to another division," she shot back. "How about it, Lincoln? Give us something concrete to go on. Rack your memory. I'm looking for what you didn't put into your report." From a remote corner of his subconscious, Lincoln dredged up several details he had overlooked when he drafted his report. "Something's very wrong with the Saudi." "Mentally or medically?" "Medically. He kept scratching at different parts of his body, his upper arm, his chest, his ribs. He seemed to itch all over. His skin was sallow. At first I thought it was because of the dim lighting, but when he stood up to go, he passed under a bulb and I saw that he really was yellowish. Another thing, he was sweating, even though it wasn't warm in the room. The perspiration on his forehead appeared to crystallize into a fine white powder." Crystal Quest sat back in her chair and exchanged looks with the MD on her staff, who directed the section that provided psychological and medical profiles of world leaders. "What do you make of that, Archie?" "There are several possibilities. The start of chronic kidney failure has to be one of them. It's a condition that could go on for 5-10 years without becoming life-threatening." "He took pills," Lincoln remembered. "Small, big, did you notice the color or the shape?" "Oval, very big, the kind I'd have trouble swallowing. It was dark, so I'm not sure of the color. Yellow, maybe. Yellow or orange." "If it is chronic kidney failure, a bunch of early treatments come to mind. Could be calcium carbonate and calcium acetate. Both are big yellowish pills, oval-shaped, taken several times a day to lower the phosphorus level of the blood when the kidney isn't filtering properly. Diet would be critical. Dairy products, liver, vegetables, nuts are high in phosphorus and would need to be avoided." Lincoln remembered another detail. "There was a bowl of nuts on the floor between us. He offered them to me, but he never helped himself to any." For once, Quest looked pleased. "That should give us something to go on. A Saudi operating out of Khartoum who may be suffering from chronic kidney failure. If he's taking pills, it would mean he's been diagnosed by a doctor somewhere, or even undergone clinical tests in a hospital. When you've gotten 40 winks, Lincoln, I want you to work with one of the artists on the third floor and see if you can't come up with a portrait. Meanwhile, we'll get our people to collect enough ammonium nitrate to fill a moving van so you can make that rendezvous in New Jersey with the would-be Wall Street bomber, Leroy Streeter." "Do I go back to Boa Vista the night of the new moon to sell radioactive waste to the Saudi?" Lincoln asked.
"I don't think that'll be necessary," Quest said. "We have a good working relationship with SIDE. We'll send in a para-team to back up the Argentine state intelligence people. They can encircle Boa Vista the night of the new moon."
"That's the 4th of next month," one of the Wallas noted.
"We'll let SIDE pick up the Saudi and work him over,"
she added with a harsh laugh.
"Their methods of interrogation are less sophisticated than ours, but more cost-efficient. When they're finished interrogating him, they can feed him to one of Daoud's alligators, and America will have one less enemy to worry about."
"I want to make sure we get the Italian girl out before all hell breaks loose at Triple Border," Lincoln said. He fingered his cane and rested the tip of it on Crystal Quest's desk. "I don't want her to end up like Jamila in Beirut."
"You're a vulgar romantic," Quest complained. "We'll sneak her out of there the afternoon of the day we close in on the Saudi."
"I want you to give me your word." The sudden silence in the room roared in Lincoln's ear. The Wallas had never heard anyone talk to the DDO quite like that. They kept their eyes fixed on their boss so as not to miss the eruption. It would be another tantrum to add to the Crystal Quest saga when the subject came up, as it invariably did, at happy hour. The color drained from her rouged cheeks. Her eyes bulged, and she looked as if she were about to choke to death on a fishbone stuck in her gullet. Then an unearthly bleat seeped from between her resplendently crimson lips. It took a moment for the people in the room to realize she was laughing.
"We'll get the girl out, Lincoln," she said as she gasped for breath. "You have my word."
They met an hour shy of first light in an enormous abandoned hangar under a curve of the Pulaski Skyway, 20 minutes from the mouth of the Holland Tunnel leading to Manhattan. At the rear of the hangar, sheets of corrugated roofing had sagged to the ground, creating a makeshift wall that blocked the gusts sweeping in from the coast. Beyond the hangar, in a hard dirt field strewn with thousands of empty plastic bottles, a small campfire burned. 20 or so homeless migrants, who picked up work as longshoremen on the Hoboken docks, were sitting with their backs against the dilapidated panel truck they used as a mobile bunk room, drinking coffee brewed over the open fire. Carried on the gusts of damp air, the tinny syncopated clatter of a Mexican mambo band reached the hangar from the panel truck's radio. Inside, Ibrahim bin Daoud scrambled up the narrow metal ladder into the back of the moving van and began inspecting the large burlap sacks, all of them stenciled in black letters, ammonium nitrate. Daoud had turned up with a sample of ammonium nitrate in a small jar and started comparing the contents of the sacks against his sample. Leroy, watching from the ground, called impatiently, "Well?"
"It is ammonium nitrate, all right," the Egyptian confirmed.
Smiling out one side of his mouth, Leroy hefted a large valise out of the trunk compartment of Daoud's rented Toyota, set it on the car's hood, and snapped open the lid. Lincoln, leaning on his cane, could see a transparent plastic sack filled with $100 bills bound in yellow wrappers. A 6-volt car battery, a coil of electric wire, a small satchel filled with tools, and several Army surplus percussion caps were also in the valise. Lincoln pointed at the money with his cane. "Count it," he told the wiry man who had driven the moving van from Pensauken outside of Camden, the assembly point for the pickup trucks bringing ammonium nitrate from various parts of the East Coast. Lincoln leaned back against a rusting stanchion to watch. He could feel the holster and the small-caliber automatic rubbing against the skin in the cavity at his lower back. Up in the van, Daoud opened each of the burlap sacks in the first two rows to inspect the contents. He played a flashlight into the depths of the van, counting the sacks out loud in Egyptian. Satisfied, he backed down the metal ladder and walked over to Lincoln.
"You are clearly someone we can do business with," he said.
The man counting the wads of bills, wearing a corduroy sports jacket with the butt of a pistol visible in a shoulder holster, looked up from the ground.
"If there are 100 bills in each packet like they say," he told Lincoln, "the count is right."
"The last thing we would do is cheat you," Daoud said. "We still have unfinished business in Boa Vista on the night of the new moon. Have you made progress with the problem of radioactive waste?"
"I have located 23,000 spent plutonium pits stored in 2 sheds at a secret military site. Security is insignificant. It consists of barbed wire around the sheds and padlocks on the doors." Daoud was someone who didn't display emotions easily.
Now, unable to contain his excitement, he danced a little jig on the cement floor of the hangar.
"My Saudi friend will be extremely pleased. In what area of Russia are these sheds?"
Lincoln only smiled.
Daoud said quickly, "It was not my intention to be indiscreet. I am trying to calculate how difficult it will be to retrieve a quantity of these pits and transport them across the various frontiers into Afghanistan."
"It can be accomplished. I shall require a down payment of $250,000 U.S. in used $100 bills, payable when I meet the Saudi in Boa Vista on the night of 4 February.
Daoud started to say that the down payment would be waiting at Boa Vista when everyone was distracted by a commotion at the rear of the hangar. Daoud's fat grandson could be seen squirming through a gap in the corrugated roofing. Crying out in Egyptian, he came padding toward his grandfather. Daoud plunged a hand into the deep pocket of his raincoat. It emerged clutching a pistol fitted with a silencer. "My grandson tells me that the men around the campfire in the field are armed with automatic rifles. He crept close and saw people distributing them from the back of the panel truck. It appears we have walked into a trap."
The headlights of a dozen automobiles, glimmering in the pre-dawn mist that clung to the ground, materialized on the ramp coming off the Pulaski Skyway half a mile away. The cars formed up in a line abreast and headed in the direction of the hangar.
Leroy cried, "Give me the detonator. I'll set off the sacks and blow them all to hell."
But before he could do anything, the wiry man who was counting the money scooped up the valise and darted out the side of the hangar, disappearing into the darkness. Daoud pulled his grandson under the moving van. Leroy grabbed Lincoln's arm and drew him toward the fallen squares of corrugated roof as the headlights began to play across the interior of the hangar.
"God damn,"
Leroy muttered, hauling a shiny wooden-handled Webley and Scott from his belt and spinning the chambers angrily.
"You was followed here, Lincoln,"
he said in a harsh whisper.
"You or Daoud were the ones who were followed,"
Lincoln retorted. Behind them they could make out the distant shouts of men coming across the field from the direction of the campfire. Leroy crouched behind a sheet of tin.
"My daddy died in one of their jails," he said. "Listen up, Lincoln. It's still night out. All we got to do is shoot down one or two of them. When the others panic and go to ground, we can squirm off into the field and make a run for it."
The automobiles, with their headlights flickering over the moving van, pulled up around the hangar. Silhouettes could be seen running in front of the headlights as men took up positions on the hangar's perimeter. Some of them were armed with rifles, others carried plastic shields. A voice Lincoln thought he recognized came echoing over a bullhorn.
"This is the FBI. We know you're in there. You are completely surrounded. You have 2 minutes to come out with your hands raised over your heads."
In the middle of the hangar, Daoud rolled clear of the moving van and rose to his feet. He raised one hand to shield his eyes from the headlights and started to walk in the direction of the bullhorn. When he was halfway there, the hand holding the pistol emerged from behind his back. Lincoln could hear the hiss of 2 silenced shots before several rifles firing on automatic cut him down. The Egyptian, propelled backward by the bullets slamming into his chest, crumpled to the cement. Sobbing like a baby, the fat Egyptian boy crawled from under the van to his grandfather's body and flung his arms around him. Then the boy stumbled to his feet and, peering through his tears into the headlights, tugged the pistol from his shoulder holster. Before he could get it clear, high-powered bullets burrowed into his chest. Sweeping the ground before them with blinding handheld Klieg lights, a line of armed men wearing black windbreakers started advancing through the hangar. When one of them turned to shout an order, Lincoln noticed the large white letters FBI on the back of his jacket.
"Wait till we see the whites of their eyes,"
Leroy whispered to Lincoln, who was hiding behind a stanchion next to the crouching Texan.
"I'll plug the one who's leading the pack."
The FBI agents drifted past the van, the beams of their Klieg lights spearing the darkness ahead of them as they closed in on the sheets of corrugated roofing at the rear of the hangar. Lincoln thought he recognized the stumpy figure of Felix Kick in the lead, hunched low with a bullhorn in one hand, a pistol in the other. When Kick was 15 yards away, he brought the bullhorn to his lips.
"This is your last chance. Leroy Streeter, Lincoln Dittman, you can't escape. Come out with your hands over your heads."
Kick took several more steps as he spoke. Leroy, steadying his shooting arm with his left hand, his left elbow locked into his gut, raised the Webley and Scott and took careful aim at Kick's head. Lincoln had hoped they would be captured without a fight, but the timing of the raid on the hangar had gone wildly wrong. The op order had called for the agents at the campfire in the field to arrive at the back of the hangar as the headlights coming off the Pulaski ramp became visible. Leroy and Daoud, distracted by the approaching automobiles, would be easily overpowered before they could put up a fight. Now there was nothing for Lincoln to do but save Kick from the bullet. In one flowing gesture, he raised his cane and brought it crashing down on Leroy's arm, shattering his wrist. Kick jumped when he heard the bone splinter. Leroy gazed up with more pure hate in his eyes than Lincoln had ever seen in a human being. His lips moved, but no words emerged until he managed to croak, "You're one of them." "Felix, we're over here," Lincoln called, stepping around the corrugated sheeting into view. Kick came over and played his light on Leroy, who was gaping in astonishment at his right hand hanging limply from the wrist. The wooden-handled Webley and Scott lay on the cement. Two FBI agents gripped Leroy under his armpits and dragged him toward the automobiles. Using a handkerchief, Kick retrieved Leroy's weapon and held it by the barrel. "Something tells me I owe you one," he said. Lincoln and Kick walked over to where Daoud and his grandson lay. Medics were kneeling next to both of them, listening with stethoscopes for any signs of life. The medics looked up at the same moment and shook their heads. Someone illuminated the corpses with a Klieg light and started taking photographs from different angles. Other agents covered the corpses with lengths of silver plastic. An agent wearing white surgeon's gloves brought over the handgun that had been retrieved from under the corpse of the fat Egyptian boy. He held it out grip first, so Kick could get a better look at it. "Holy mackerel," Kick said. He shook his head in disgust. "It sure looked like the real McCoy to me." Presiding over the formal post-mortem in the DDO's seventh-floor bailiwick at Langley, Crystal Quest made no effort to tame the shrew in her. Everything that could go wrong had gone wrong, she seethed. The adults pretending to be FBI agents in the field behind the hangar had been spotted by a child, before the raid was even underway. Daoud had walked into a hail of bullets so as not to be taken alive. Lincoln Dittman's legend was blown when he saved Kick's life. As an added extra bonus, the FBI clowns under Felix Kick's command had gunned down a juvenile armed with a plastic pistol. Holy Christ, it hadn't even been loaded with water. Leroy Streeter Jr., who would get a life sentence for attempting to blow up a square mile of Wall Street, knew precious little about the Al-Qaeda cells and less about the Saudi who was organizing them. Streeter's expertise was limited to a small group of nutty white supremacists in Texas that had already been infiltrated by so many state and federal agents. Half the group's dues came from the government. To add humiliation to embarrassment, any hope of nabbing the Saudi had evaporated the night before when the cretins from the Argentine state intelligence had bungled the raid on Boa Vista. Talk about stealth. They had headed into the Brazilian Mato Grosso in half a dozen giant army helicopters, flying at treetop level with their running lights on, for God's sake, and kicked up such a storm of sand when they touched down at the training camp that half the Fedayeen managed to slip away in the confusion. Naturally, the Saudi who had been presiding over the meeting in the low-roofed building was nowhere to be found when the side agents, backed up by a handful of the company's paramilitary people who were currently hunting for new jobs, burst through the door. So what did the raid net? I'll tell you what it netted. Are you ready for this, gentlemen and ladies? It netted two jokers from Hamas, two more from Hezbollah, seven from Egypt's Islamic Brotherhood, a drunken Irishman from the IRA, and two young females from the Basque ETA, who listed fashion model under profession when they were interrogated. Fashion model's my ass. One of them was so flat-chested she put padding in her brassiere to break even, for Christ's sake. No shit, we could have snared twice as many terrorists using flypaper tacked to the rafters of any bar on the main drag of Foz do Iguaçu. Quest appeared to come up for air. In the several seconds of silence, Lincoln was able to get a word in. Well, he said, we did pin down the identity of the Saudi. The speculation about the chronic kidney failure had been the starting point. On the theory that Leroy Streeter's offhand remark about the Saudi's wealth, thanks to Allah and his late father, he is very rich, would suggest he'd been diagnosed and treated by an expensive private physician. Riyadh intelligence authorities had combed the clinics frequented by the royal family and affluent members of the business community. If they came up with anything, they kept it to themselves. Confronted with the Saudi foot-dragging, the American Secretary of State had been persuaded to take the matter up with his Saudi counterpart. Within days, the intelligence authorities in Riyadh had pouched a thick dossier to Langley filled with hundreds of photographs and associated biographical information. Lincoln had sorted through the photos in the conference room next to the DDO's office, with Quest peering anxiously over his shoulder. He came across several that gave him pause. No, that's not him, he would finally say. Our Saudi had incredibly intense eyes that seemed to look into you rather than at you. Going through the pouch a second time, Lincoln had used a magnifying glass to study the group photographs. Suddenly, he had leaned over the table to get a closer look at one man. I think maybe... You think what, for Christ's sake? Maybe this is our Saudi. Yes, there's no doubt about it. Look at those goddamn eyes. The group photograph had been taken years before at the wedding of a 17-year-old Saudi to a Syrian girl who was a distant relative of his. The bridegroom's name, according to the caption provided by the Riyadh intelligence people, was Osama bin Laden. He turned out to have a central registry file dating back to when he became involved in the anti-Soviet jihad in Afghanistan. The son of the Yemeni-born construction tycoon, Muhammad Awad bin Laden, who had made a fortune in Saudi Arabia, Osama, according to Riyadh, was considered to be the black sheep of the 53 siblings in the extremely wealthy bin Laden family, in part because of his disdain for the ruling Saudi royal family and their ties to the United States, in part because of his recent obsession with Islamic fundamentalism. Okay, we have his name and a mugshot to go with him, Quest was conceding, the shrew in her only partly assuaged. A goddamn pity we don't have his warm body also. What we need to do, one of the staffers ventured from the sideline, is put pressure on the Sudanese to hand him over to us, or at least expel him from Sudan. I promoted bin Laden to the top of our wish list, Quest announced. We wish he were dead. Something tells me we had better get our paws on this Osama character before he gets his paws on radioactive waste and builds himself a dirty bomb. Amen, said Lincoln. 6 weeks later, Lincoln, in Rome for 2 weeks of R&R, hired a taxi to drive him out to Hadrian's sprawling villa near Tivoli and spent the afternoon limping around the site in a light spring rain, trying to distinguish myth from reality. Which was the flesh and blood Publius Aelius Hadrianus? Which the legend he had consigned to history? Was he the emperor who ruthlessly suppressed the Jewish revolt of 132 and paraded the survivors through Rome in chains? Or the patron of the arts who presided over the construction of the vast country villa outside of Rome, and most especially its entrancing circular library, where he spent afternoons studying the manuscripts he accumulated? Or, as seemed likely, was there something of the real Hadrian present in both incarnations? Didn't truth provide the spinal column in every legend? In early evening, Lincoln had the driver drop him off across the Tiber on the Janicular. He checked the address scrawled on the slip of paper in his wallet and headed uphill, walking at a leisurely pace so as not to tire his leg, until he came to the luxurious four-story apartment house near the fountain where Romans lingered to inhale the negative ions from the cascading water. He settled onto the stone railing near the fountain, with Rome stretched out behind him, and breathed in some of the negative ions himself. It surely wouldn't hurt him, he thought. These days he was walking without the aid of a cane, but his leg tired easily. The doctors at the company clinic in Maryland had warned him the pain would never completely go away. He would learn to live with it, they promised. That's what everyone did with pain. The bells on a church uphill from the fountain tolled the hour, and Lincoln checked his wristwatch. Either it or the bells were 4 minutes off, but what did it matter? In the end, time was something you killed. Across the street, a doorman in a long blue overcoat with gold piping removed his cap to salute the very elegantly dressed woman emerging from the building. She held the leash of a small dog in one gloved hand. In the other, she clasped the small hand of a little boy dressed in short pants and a knee-length overcoat buttoned up to the neck. With the dog leading the way, the woman and the boy crossed the street to pass the fountain on their way downhill to the music school. Lincoln slipped off the stone rail as they came abreast of him. Hello, he said. The woman stopped. Do I know you? Don't you remember me? The woman, who spoke English with what Lincoln took to be an Italian accent,
looked puzzled.
"I'm sorry, no, should I?"
Linka noticed a small silver crucifix hanging from the delicate silver chain around her neck. "My name's Dittman, Lincoln Dittman. We met in Brazil, in a border town called Foz do Iguaçu. Your name, your daytime name, was Lucha."
"Mama, que dice?"
A nervous smile tugged at the corners of the woman's mouth.
"My daytime name happens to be the same as my nighttime name. It is Fiamma, Fiamma Segre."
Lincoln found himself speaking with some urgency, as if a great deal depended on convincing her that daytime names were never the same as nighttime names. "I told you it would end. You said you would breed baby polyesters on a farm in Tuscany. I am elated to see you found something more interesting to do with your life." The nervous smile worked its way up to the woman's frightened eyes.
"Polyester is a synthetic fabric," she said softly.
She pulled gently at the boy's hand.
"I'm afraid we must be on our way. It was a pleasure talking to you, Lincoln Dittman. Goodbye."
"Goodbye," Lincoln said. Although his heart wasn't in it, he forced himself to smile back at her. 1997. Martin Odom is mesmerized to tears. The jetliner elbowed through the towering clouds and emerged into an airspace as cheerless as sky gets without sun. Dark-pitted fields ribbed with irrigation gutters unfurled under the belly of the plane. From his window seat, Martin Odom watched Prague tilt up in its oval frame as if it were perched on the high end of a teeter board. In his mind's eye, he imagined the buildings yielding to gravity and sliding downslope into the Vltava, the broad mud-colored river meandering through the center of the city that looked, to Martin's jaundiced eye, like a beautiful woman who had been tempted by a facelift too many. The plane's wing dipped and Prague leveled out and the hills rimming the bowl of the city swam into view on the horizon, with the prefabricated communist-era high-rise apartment boxes spilling over the crests into the bleak countryside. A moment later, the tarmac rushed up to graze the wheels of the plane.
"Welcome to Prague," announced a recorded voice over the public address system. "We hope your flight has been enjoyable. The captain and his crew thank you for flying Czech Airlines."
"You're definitely welcome," Martin heard himself respond. The buxom English woman in the next seat must have heard him, too, because she favored him with the look reserved for passengers having conversations with recorded announcements. Martin felt obliged to decipher his remark. "Any airline that gets me where I'm going in one piece has my unstinting gratitude," he informed her.
"If you are frightened of flying," she retorted, "you should entertain the idea of traveling by train."
"Frightened of trains, too," Martin said gloomily. He thought of the Italian girl Paura that Lincoln Dittman had come across in Foz do Iguaçu, the one who was afraid of her shadow. He wondered what had become of her. To this day, he wasn't 100% sure the woman Lincoln had accosted in the genicular and the call girl in Brazil were one and the same person. There had been a physical resemblance, so Lincoln had claimed, but the two women had been a world apart in mood and manner. "Frightened of arriving places I haven't been to before," Martin told his neighbor now. "Frightened of motion and movement. Frightened of the going and the getting there." The Englishwoman was eager to put an end to the exchange and formulated a cutting remark that would accomplish it, but she decided she might be dealing with an authentic maniac after all and kept her mouth shut. Making his way through the crowded terminal, following the overhead signs with images of buses on them, a thin beady glued to his lower lip, Martin found his path blocked by a slight young man with an ironic grimace pasted on his fleshy lips. He was dressed in khaki jodhpurs that buttoned at the ankles and a green Tyrolean jacket with tarnished brass buttons. For an instant, Martin had thought he had been spotted by the local constabulary, but the young man quickly made it clear he was freelancing.
"Mister, no difference if you are come to Praha for business or pleasure. In both conditions, you will be requiring a fixer, whose honorarium will be conspicuously less than what you will find yourself expending on hotels and transportation and meals if you do not accept to employ my services."
The young man, anxious to please, doffed his deerstalker and, pinching one of the two visors between a thumb and two fingers, held it over his solar plexus.
"Radek at your beck and call for an insignificant 30 crowns an hour, which translates into one lousy US dollar.
Martin was tempted.
What made you pick me? He wanted to know.
You look reasonably U.S., and I need to varnish my English for the year-end examinations that must be passed with flying colors to arrive into medical school.
Flying colors, not floating colors. The young man beamed.
Flying colors it will be from this second in time until Alzheimer's sets in.
Martin knew himself to be a poor judge of age, but Roddick looked a little old to be thinking of going to medical school, and he said so.
I am a late blossomer, the young man said with a disarming grin.
Martin wasn't so much interested in saving money as time. His instinct told him that he had to get into and out of Prague before Crystal Quest, whose operatives could not be far behind, informed the local security people of his presence, before the Chechens who murdered Talat Bekrabani caught up with him. He produced a $10 bill from his shirt pocket. Fair enough, Roddick. Here are 10 hours in advance. I want to take a bus into the city. I want to rent a room in a cheap hotel in the Vysherat quarter that has a fire staircase leading to an employee's entrance. Then I want to make a phone call from the central post office, after which I would like to eat a copious vegetarian meal in a cheap restaurant.
I know definitely the cheap hotel. It is former secret police dormitory turned into a student bed and breakfast when communism demised. When you are checkered in, I will pilot you to a mom-and-pop's Yugoslav eatery, not much grander than a crackle in the wall, all vegetarian except for the meat.
Martin had to laugh. Sounds like just the ticket. Roddick tried the phrase on his tongue.
Just the ticket. I see the meaning. And for after the meal, what about girls? I know a bar where university students in miniskirts wait on tables to supplement their stipends. Some of them are not against supplementing the supplements.
We'll save the girls for my next trip to Prague, Roddick. Martin took a last drag on the beady and embedded the burning end in the sand of an ashtray. After the mom-and-pop's crackle in the wall, I want to go to... He hauled out the envelope that Talat Bekrabani had given him in London and looked at what the old man had written on the back of it. To the Vysherat train station on Svobodova Street.
The Vysherat station was closed by the communists. Trains pass there but do not stop. For a while it was an abandoned building where you could buy drugs. I am hearing it was hired to check people who buy and sell.
Buy and sell what? Roddick shrugged.
Only God knows, and he has not so far shared the information with me.
I want to know, too. I want to find out what they buy and sell. Roddick fitted his deerstalker back onto his head at a rakish angle.
Then please to follow me, mister.
The hotel in the Vysherat quarter turned out to be spotlessly clean and inexpensive if you didn't formally register and paid 2 nights in advance with American dollars, which Martin immediately agreed to do. And the narrow fire staircase led, 4 floors down, to the kitchen and a back door giving onto a courtyard that gave onto a side street. The central post office, reached after a short ride on a red and cream double trolley, had a window for international calls. Martin jotted the Crown Heights phone number on a pad and waited his turn and squeezed into the empty booth that smelled of stale cologne when his ticket was called. Hello, he cried into the phone when he heard Stella's voice breasting the static on the other end.
Why are you shouting? She demanded.
He lowered his voice.
Because I'm further away than the last time I called. Don't tell me where you are. There's been a bizarre echo in my line the last few days.
Doesn't matter, Martin said. They'll take 2 or 3 minutes to figure out it's an international call. Then they'll need 2 or 3 days to find out which city it came from. And another week to get the local spooks to determine I'm calling from the central post office in Prague.
Now you've gone and told them.
They won't believe me. They'll think I'm planting phony clues to throw them off. What did you do with yourself today?
Just came back from the dentist. He's making me a new front tooth.
Money down the drain. I like the chipped tooth. Made you look...
Finish what you started to say, for God's sake. Every time you get personal, you let go of the end of the sentence and it drifts off like a hot air balloon.
Breakable. That's the word that was on the tip of my tongue.
I'm not sure how to take that. What's so great about looking breakable?
For starters, means you're not already broken. People who are broken have several selves. Estelle is your real name, isn't it?
The family name Kastner was assigned to us when we came to America. They wanted to change my first name, too, but I wouldn't let them. Estelle is me.
When he didn't respond, she said, "You still there?" "I'm thinking about what you said. I know I must have met people who aren't living in legends, I just don't remember when."
"Legends, as in having different names?"
"It's much more than different names. It has to do with having several biographies, several attitudes, several ways of looking at the world, several ways of giving and taking pleasure. It has to do with being so broken that the king's horses and the king's men would have a hard time putting you together again."
"Listen up, Martin."
"Terrific. Now they'll know it's me calling."
"How can they be sure I'm not using a phony name to throw them off?"
"There's something in what you say."
"I lied to you last time we spoke. I said if I joined you in Europe, there wouldn't be strings attached. If you let me come, there will be strings attached."
Martin didn't know what to say. He stifled the "uh-huh" and let the silence stand.
"You don't know what to say," Stella guessed.
"Strings are attached to puppets," Martin finally said. "It's not an image of you that I put much store in."
"The strings won't be attached to me or you. They'd be attached to my coming over. Remember when we were going into Israel and I told that policeman you were my lover?"
Martin smiled to himself.
"And I told him you had a tattoo of a Siberian night moth under your right breast."
"Got one," Stella announced. He didn't understand.
"Got what?" "Tattoo of a Siberian night moth under my right breast. A Jamaican tattoo artist on Empire Boulevard did it. That's the string that's attached when we next meet. I'm going to have to show it to you to prove it's there, since it's not your style to take my word for anything as important as that. Then we'll see if one thing leads to another."
Martin thought of the whore Dante had come across in Beirut.
"I heard of a girl who actually had a moth tattooed under her breast. Her name was Jamila. Did you really get one?"
He could hear the laughter in her voice.
"Uh-huh."
"Stealing my uh-huhs," Martin said.
"Plan to steal more than that," she shot back.
He changed the subject. "I was scared today."
"Of what?"
"Where I'm at, as I've never been before. That frightens me."
"Okay, here's the deal. You better get used to being where you've never been to before. I'll hold your hand, okay?"
"I suppose so."
"If this is you enthusiastic, I'd hate to see you reluctant."
"Fact is, I'm not sure."
"Ever hear the story of the Russian peasant who was asked if he knew how to play the violin?"
"I'm not sure," he replied. "Never tried." She snickered at her own joke.
"You need to try, Martin, to know if you can or you can't."
"I can see you're right. I just don't feel you're right." She digested that.
"Why did you call me?"
"Wanted to hear your voice. Wanted to make sure you're still you."
"Well, you've heard it, and I've heard yours. Where does that leave us, Martin?"
"I'm not sure." They both laughed at the "I'm not sure." "I mean, I still have to find the person who went AWOL from his marriage."
"Let it go. Forget Samat. Come home, Martin."
"If I let it go, the person who came home wouldn't be me. Aside from that, a lot of questions are out trawling for answers."
"When the answers are elusive, you have to learn to live with the questions."
"I need to go. Stella?"
Okay, go. I'll replay the conversation in my head after you hang up. I'll sift through it looking for meanings I missed."
"Don't worry, be happy."
"Don't worry, be happy. What's that supposed to mean?"
"It's a song from the top 10 in the late 80s. Thought of it today. They were playing it over and over on a jukebox in Paraguay when a guy I knew was there."
"Was the they a girl?"
"A bunch of girls. Prostitutes working a bar who bought lottery tickets from an old Polish gentleman."
"You depress me, Martin. There's so much about you I don't know."
"I depress me too, for the same reason."
End of disc 6. Please continue with the next disc.